This is the State of Things broadcasting live from the Upstage Cabaret at Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stacio. You know, many birds are known for their sweet little songs, the nightingale, the canary, the mockingbird, but not the vulture. No, the vulture makes a far different sound, and it's hardly... That's a vulture. We actually have vulture sounds. It's great in our library. Vultures actually, this turns out kind of interesting, one of the only species of birds without a voice box. And that is precisely what attracted author Lee Zacharias to the vulture. Her new book of essays is called The Only Sounds We Make. And it's about voice, and it's about memory, and it takes its inspiration everywhere from vultures and spiders to her father's death, to photography, and to the Great Migration. Lee Zacharias is the author and a creative writing professor at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. Welcome, Lee. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
You are not the author. You are an author at UNCG, a robust arts program there. And this book is wonderful, The Only Sounds We Make Collection. It's actually personal essays, but it adds up to a memoir in your...
In many ways, it does. A lot of people would call it a collection of short memoirs, but I really make a distinction between the essay and the memoir. I see the memoir as driven by experience and the essay as driven by idea, which makes it sound a little dull. But I think the essay goes a little bit beyond what memoir does. We can only apprehend the real world through our senses. But I think that the essay tries to go beyond that and to see into a kind of metaphysical world through our experience and through the senses with which we apprehend the real world.
Well, I think this is exactly what your book does in a way that is utterly sublime, and that is that we have experiences, but then we make meaning of them, right? We turn those experiences into ideas, and therein lies the gap between the real world out there and how we perceive it and then how we communicate that world. And I think that, is that part of what you're sort of aiming at in this book?
Absolutely.
It's fantastic. The is there a uniting thread then? All of these are personal experiences. They were part of your life.
Yes, all of them are personal experiences. Some are personal experiences with family. Others are personal experiences with the natural world.
The essay "My Dog Eats the Past." You did a lot of research on dogs. Tell us about that.
I did do a lot of research about dogs. The essay is on one level about my dog who suddenly, when he was about 8 years old, started consuming photograph albums, baby books. When he was a puppy, he was very unselective. You know, couches, quilts, anything would do. But when he was 8 years old, all of a sudden he seemed determined to eat everything that we keep to remind us of where we've been, the whole past. So on one level, it's just an essay about that. On another level, it's an essay about dog, capital D, and the sort of collective memory of the species. We're told that dogs have no real long-term memory. All the training books tell you not to spank the puppy for peeing on the rug because he won't make the association between the punishment and the crime. But dogs actually do have long-term memories. There's a kind of collective memory, and their memory just works in a very different way than ours does. Their memories are in their nose and in their ears. And so on another level, it's about the dog in general. But finally, to me, it's not an essay about either one of those things. It's an essay about the relationship of past, present, and future. The notion that we don't really know what the future holds, but actually we do. There's one sure thing, the one terrible sure thing about the future is loss. And so that's what the essay is about on that level.
Will you read for us from that essay?
Yes.
My Dog Eats the Past.
I'll just read the first paragraph, which is very short. Bye-bye, childhood. So long, my husband's early years. Sons, your achievements are confetti on the carpet. It's adios to first teeth, first words and graduation photos. The dog is on a rampage. The past is no longer even history. The present is a cleanup job. All he's left us is that undocumented uncertainty we like to call the future.
Lee Zacharias reading from her collection of essays, The Only Sounds We Make. And as I read this, I realized what you were doing. You can create this metaphor about your past being churned up. We can learn about dogs, but then this sort of larger question of how it is that we know who we are, create an identity, and what it does to us when those artifacts that make up the narrative are torn up. It's a fascinating thought. Also memory, collective memory. Mammals, of course, your dog does remember you. They know that they love you, and they show you affection time after time. That's a kind of memory. But then I began to think about insects, about other animals that we would think have lower order of thinking, and yet generation after generation, they repeat the same behavior. So institutionally, right, as a species, they have a memory.
They have memory, and most of us will agree that mammals have emotions. Those of us who own dogs, cats, know that they have emotions. Elephants have been in the news a lot lately because they're so endangered by poachers in Africa, and we know that elephants mourn when one of their number die. But we don't know that much about the creatures that we really consider to be of a lower order, the creatures that we try to avoid, the creepy crawlies, the spiders. And I am as arachnophobic as anybody. And yet, you know, the wolf spider, the spider that carries the egg sac on her back, if she loses that egg sac, she will pick up something that replicates it in terms of texture and weight. It might be a little piece of dandelion fluff, a mouse turd or something, and she will carry that on her back. Now, is that just instinct? Is it grief? Is it love? Or is the only difference the fact that we articulate one?
Yeah, and that's it. You did that human thing where you said, is it just instinct? In other words, we privilege narrative as the only form of legitimate memory, and therefore all others are inferior. But then we trick ourselves into believing that that narrative we tell ourselves, it's true. Do you find yourself sort of questioning your past and kind of what's the real deal? What's behind the curtain?
Well, I'm sure if I showed this book to anyone in my family, they would quibble quite a bit. You know, this didn't happen that way. I never said that. And I think that's true in general for people who write memoirs. Memory is a notoriously faulty tool. And there are interesting studies on memory that claim our fondest memories, the ones that we visit most often, are in fact our least accurate, because every time we visit them, we make subtle changes, changes so subtle we don't even realize we're making them.
Yeah, we like it because we've turned it into the thing we like, and yet we trust it. No, your father's essay, I think, was profound and really a deep meditation. And this is it had to do with your father, and it's also an essay on vultures. Tell us about it, please.
Well, I became interested in vultures because I do a lot of nature photography, and I wound up at some point surrounded by a flock of black vultures, which is a pretty creepy thing. And we're told that they have no voice box and that they make no sound. They do make very small sounds, and the way I would describe the sound is a kind of low woofing in the throat. It's almost like the sound a dog makes just before he barks. Not the bark itself, but the anticipation of the bark. And so I became very interested in vultures for that reason. And I started to write an essay that was just about vultures, but it probably provided more information than anybody ever wants to know.
Really.
And the material had no resonance whatsoever, no emotional resonance. So as I began to bring my father more and more into the essay, the material about vultures began to take on emotional significance. Why my father? Because my father father was a very silent man. He was a man who chose not to speak. He had beautiful handwriting and absolutely no use for words. One of the last times I saw my father, he showed up unexpected on my doorstep, never mind that he lived 2 days' drive away, suitcases in hand. And when I said, "Oh, I wasn't expecting you," he said, "Told you I was going to be up here sometime this summer." And so there was no food in the house. We had just gotten back from a trip ourselves, and I took him to the grocery store and was trying to pin him down as to how long he was going to stay so I would know what to buy. And he said, "Trying to get rid of me?" So that night he told me about his final arrangements, which were to be cremated and to have his ashes scattered from a plane over the Gulf of Mexico. He wanted no service, no memorial of any kind. And I think outside of the time when I was a child that I don't remember, it's probably the only time in my life that I told my father I loved him. And I said, "Why do you want to do this? Why do you want to just disappear? Don't you think I love you?" The next morning I got up and he's already going down the stairs with his suitcases in his hand, and I go, "But you just got here. Why are you leaving?" And he said, "We said everything we needed to say last night. Anything else would just be loose chatter." And I never forgot that. And so it seemed natural to bring my father together with the vultures, because he was a man who could have had a voice but chose not to. And of course, as a writer, I'm a person who does choose to use her voice.
Will you read for us from that essay?
Yes. To see a turkey vulture up close is to know the bird's tragic beauty, for there is a majesty to the crimson head. Bare save for a sparse black stubble, the bird looks less bald than vulnerable and shorn, a Nazi collaborator exposed before a French village. The raised nostrils have no internal division. They are like the space left by a handle, the eye of a bloody needle of bone. All the vilification and fear the vulture inspires seem contained in the sidelong, wary sadness of the eye, not the sharp black stare of an eagle or a heron's mean pupil in its fixed yellow ring, but a doleful attention that is the same soft shade of brown as my dog's. The bird's muteness sits upon its shoulders. It knows what death tastes like, but cannot speak of the flavor. To see a turkey vulture up close is to be reminded of death, not as portent, but as the weight of an unbearable witness. His dirge has no throat, his wisdom no voice. 2 million years of silence haunt his expression. To see a turkey vulture up close is to know what loneliness looks like.
Lee Zacharias reading from her essay, Buzzards, from the collection of essays called The Only Sounds We Make. I'm curious to know whether you think now, looking back, you embarked on the essay on vultures in some subtle way, some subliminal way, you were thinking about your father from the start.
I think that's true. The first essay I wrote about him was called A House in Florida, and it's about the house that I inherited from him when he died. And I didn't want to repeat myself, and that's why I think I resisted for a while trying to bring him into the Buzzards essay, but finally it seemed natural to do so.
You, as you worked through this, did it become, so now you start out, you think you're writing an essay on vultures, your father becomes a greater part of your consciousness, you include him in the essay. Did his story become more clear to you as you started working through it?
Yes, I think so. My father was a somewhat difficult man, and I think writing about him through that essay and through the essay titled A House in Florida, I tried to come to some kind of understanding of him. So it was a way of grieving by coming to understand someone that you really didn't understand very well in life and who chose to make himself difficult to understand.
And he came to a tragic end.
Yes, he did. He committed suicide.
And you say that you in a sense, there were indications of this long before. You're not sure when he wrote the note. Is that right?
No. My father left a note. I inherited his house, but I also inherited the responsibility for his companion of the last 19 years of his life. And he left a note that said he wanted her to be able to live in the house for as long as she was able. And I had no way of knowing whether he had written that note the morning before he killed himself or 15 years before. There was no date on it. There was no way to know. But he had said all his life that that was the way he was going to end his life. And in some ways, I have to say that the fact that he gave warning made it actually more shocking when he did than if he hadn't given warning at all. It was a little bit like someone calling wolf all his life, and then I found out on the answering machine I was away while he did this, and came back, and my young son sort of danced into the kitchen. This was before voicemail. Pressed the button on the answering machine, said, "Wonder who called us while we were away." And the first message was from his next door neighbor.
Mm. What do you make of this, Lee? You are a writer. You're able to communicate. You have a voice, and it is a craft to get this message out. We're meaning makers, aren't we, as humans? We take even the most obscure kinds of metaphor and ultimately listen to the message and realize it's telling us something. How the vultures are about my father, I didn't know until I started. And it seems in your father's case, he didn't have that gift, the ability to sort of make that meaning out of these experiences.
No, he didn't have it, or if he had it, he refused to use it.
So what about this as a gift? I mean, you think about writing and the arts in general, and sort of maybe the gift that all of us have to do this trick, to try to make meaning out of that ultimate, the thing we share, loss and grief, the one thing we refuse to face and kind of always try to turn into a different story.
Absolutely. Philip Lopate says that the personal essay is about the way life comes at you. I would amend that to say that it's about what you make of the way life comes at you. And the goal of it is for other people to recognize meaning, to recognize their own experience, and perhaps to feel a little less lonely for that reason, or else to recognize their experience and to be able to see it in a whole new way and to give it a whole different meaning.
You've done, I think, an ingenious and an artful job of just that, and I thank you so much for being on the program, Lee Zacharias. Lee Zacharias is an author, a creative writing professor at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. She's going to read tonight, 7 o'clock at the Barnes & Noble at the Friendly Center here in Greensboro. And then Saturday morning, she's going to be at McIntyre's Books in Pittsburgh. That's at 11 o'clock. The book is called The Only Sounds We Make. Just ahead, a rock band that is an indie band that's orchestral. Well, you're going to hear them in just a minute. The Collection will play live, and here's a little sample right now.
I was singing by the river, waiting for my troubles to be gone. And you were coming through the speakers, sliding down my ears and played their drums. And I was sick with holy fever, burning up with blankets and with love. And you would love me like a mother, cooling me with freezing baptism. Ooh. times that I had struggled, oh, so long to say your name without some fear. Finding out your name was nothing more than just a name.